We must carry the knowledge of our culture in the wombs to give birth to the brighter sun that could perhaps illuminate the children of our future. We started singing songs of bravery.
WBAI New York. Same wind that oppressed us to reinforce elements of life. Sofrito. It's 7 a.m. here in New York at 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org. Coming up next is What's Going On with Johanna Fernandez.
So we reach for the wind in the sky to guide us, landed us on 12 inches of wax. As pupils become intact for teaching, I
hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today.
Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Good morning, New York, and good morning, world. Michael, thank you so much for Elements of Life by Sofrito. It's 7:01 a.m. and 36 degrees in Central Park. We'll see a high near 55 degrees, and it will be sunny this Friday, December 15th, 2023. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, free speech radio, WBAI, at 99.5 FM in New York and WBAI.org on the web. I am Johanna Fernandez, your Friday host of What's Going On. Historians rely on archival libraries and archival collections to write history. But materials collected in archival spaces have historically excluded the people at the bottom of society. This morning, we'll talk to an archivist assigned to one of the rarest projects in American history. About a year and a half ago, she was assigned the job of cataloging the archive of imprisoned radio journalist and veteran Black Panther, Mumia Abu-Jamal, when her employer acquired his papers, 97 archival boxes of materials Abu-Jamal had collected over the course of his imprisonment, including material he gathered during his 28 years on death row. As fate would have it, Brown could not have chosen a person more removed from Abu-Jamal's life and from his life experience for this job. But the experience of processing Abu-Jamal's papers profoundly changed the outlook of Abu-Jamal's archivist. This morning, we'll talk to her, the archivist who pored over 97 archival boxes of materials belonging to an American prisoner. Amanda Knox is that person, the assistant archivist at Brown University's Pembroke Center, who organized the papers of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll also update you on the Gaza crisis. But first, here's the Pacifica Network News.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
And they'll face more death and destruction to their families and to their homeland. They need our help. And they need it right now, not after the eggnog.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby is putting heat on House Republicans for holding up supplemental aid to Ukraine. On Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin said Western support for Kiev is weakening and peace will only come from Russia's imminent victory. Ohio Republican Congressman Dave Joyce says he hasn't seen any evidence President Joe Biden was corrupt as vice president. He did vote for the impeachment inquiry, but says he views it as an investigation.
I mean, I think that the evidence needs to be produced that people can make that determination in whether it's there or whether it's not.
Joyce says impeachment has become politicized and has been abused in recent years. Vice President Kamala Harris is urging the administration to show more concern for Palestinian lives amidst the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. According to the New York Times, White House officials are telling their Israeli peers they should stop large-scale attacks in favor of targeted strikes, and Biden is becoming increasingly public in his criticism of how Israel is waging the war.
I want them to be focused on how to save civilian lives, not stop going after Hamas, but be more careful.
Yesterday was the 11th anniversary of the Sandy Hook school shooting. Democratic Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy is calling for stricter gun safety laws.
We just need to make a decision as a country as to whether we want to live in a world in which this carnage continues. This isn't an accident. It isn't bad luck. It's a choice.
Rudy Giuliani didn't take to the witness stand Thursday in his ongoing defamation trial brought forth by two Georgia election workers he accused of voter fraud. But he says he still might.
When I was a prosecutor, defense lawyers never told me if the guy was going to testify or not. So I sure as heck am not going to tell them whether I am or I'm not.
U.S. District Judge Beryl Howell has already ruled Giuliani is liable for defaming the poll workers. The trial now is to decide on damages. Some state lawmakers in New Jersey hope to boost turnout in primary elections by allowing 17-year-olds to vote if they turn 18 by the general election. Makari Vargas with the New Jersey Institute for Social Justice says voting is habit-forming, but even more so before the disruptions that come after high school.
Whereas if you introduce it while they're still in school, it becomes a part of their curriculum, a part of their civics education.
A bill to lower the voting age has passed the state house and awaits action in the Senate. 18 other states and Washington, D.C. have similar laws. Finally, another poll shows former President Donald Trump ahead of President Joe Biden in 7 key battleground states. The survey from Morning Consult and Bloomberg found voters favor Trump on the economy. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, filling in for Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Thank you, Edwin. It's 7:06 a.m. and you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial free speech radio, WBAI, at 99.5 FM in New York and WBAI.org on the web. I am Johanna Fernandez, your Friday host of What's Going On. And here's your update on the crisis in Palestine from Al Jazeera. At least 12 people were killed in strikes on the UN school in Khan Yunis and adjacent homes in southern Gaza. Palestinian telecommunications firms say services cut in Gaza once again due to Israeli attacks will have consequences. No Gaza's government media office government media offices say that this communications blackout hampers rescue efforts there. Israel concluded a 60-hour raid in Jenin, killing 11 Palestinians. This is in the West Bank. Forces are conducting more overnight raids across the occupied West Bank. Dozens of countries urge Israel to tackle settler violence in the occupied West Bank. Again, this is not in Gaza. Since the start of October, settlers have committed more than 343 violent attacks, killing 8 Palestinian civilians and injuring more than 83. They've forced 1,026 Palestinians from their homes. And at least 18,787 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks since October 7th. The revised death toll in Israel stands at 1,200. Meanwhile, as you heard, Biden wants Israel to be, quote, more careful in Gaza and continues to give Israel military support. This is something I've said previously, but what we see happening in Palestine is an open proxy war on the part of the Americans in Palestine. This is an open American proxy war in Palestine. Without American weapons, the Israelis couldn't conduct the genocide they are conducting in Palestine. And this raises for me or reminds me of Malcolm X's words on the crisis. He says, quote, "The Palestinians' struggle is a moral battle, a universal fight, a resonating echo of the battles waged by oppressed people across the globe," unquote. And the injustices that are happening in that region today are so rank and transparent that they rankle people to the core. At the center of that battle are two major structures of oppression. The first is the mass displacement of people from their lands, and the second is the dehumanization of the displaced, which is necessary to justify the ongoing stealing of lands and the permanent dispossession of people from their lands. I might add that that the other structure of settler colonial domination is criminalization. And so the number of political prisoners in Gaza, or they've been taken to Israel, is just astronomical. Thousands and thousands of Palestinians have been picked up from the street and put in prison. And even before this conflict, one in five Palestinians had seen prison. One in five Palestinians imprisoned. The other structure of settler colonial domination has historically been genocide. It's 7:11 a.m. and 37 degrees in Central Park, and we stand here at WBAI with the people of Palestine. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York and WBAI.org on the web. I am Johanna Fernandez, your Friday host of What's Going On. And that was an excerpt from Vampire Nation, composed in prison, actually on death row, by Mumia Abu-Jamal. This was arranged by Marcus Grant, a graduate student at Brown University, and performed at the Voices of Mass Incarceration Symposium at Brown University this past December. And I'm getting word in from Mariposa Fernandez, who reports that there was a meeting last night of the union I belong to at the City University of New York, the PSC CUNY union of the staff and faculty of the City University of New York. And this is a resounding victory. This was the PSC CUNY resolution for ceasefire. It was expected that this was going to be a very difficult vote, but this resolution passed by a wide margin, a vote of 117 in favor and 37 people opposed, 10 abstained, and Mariposa spoke. And she spoke the words of Rafat Al-Arir, the professor and poet who was killed just last week in Gaza, his home targeted very directly by the Israelis. And this is what he wrote just the week before last. If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings, make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale. And this is a message from Mariposa Fernandez, a poet herself, who was present at this meeting of the PSC CUNY delegate assembly, where a resolution for ceasefire passed by a wide margin, a vote of 117 in favor. This is a poem by poet and professor Rafat Al-Arir, who was killed in Gaza just last week. Last year, the Ivy League institution Brown University acquired the papers of imprisoned radio journalist and veteran Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal. 97 archival boxes of materials Abu-Jamal had collected over the course of his imprisonment, including materials he gathered during his 28 years on death row. Those papers were opened to the public this past September, and they form part of the archival collection at Brown University's Hay Library. The significance of these papers for future historians is hard to grasp. Historians rely on archival libraries and archival collections to write history, but materials collected in archival spaces have historically excluded the people at the bottom of society, which is why these papers are so significant. In the last 30 years, prisons have taken center stage in American life, yet the historical archive has a scarcity of stories of incarcerated people. During these same decades, the United States has imprisoned a larger segment of its population than at any other moment in American history, and the carceral state is today the third largest employer in the nation. How can we understand American society without understanding prison life from the inside? For perspective, imagine what the history of slavery would look like without the narratives of enslaved people. This morning, we'll talk to the archivist who was assigned the job of processing, organizing, and cataloging the papers of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And this is one of the rarest archival projects in American history. Amanda Knox is the assistant archivist at the Pembroke Center at Brown University, where she has worked in various capacities since 2016. Her primary duty is to process archival collections and prepare them for research use. Previously, Amanda has worked in private and public libraries and state archives. Amanda Knox, welcome to What's Going On.
Good morning, Johanna. Thank you so much for having me today.
Good morning for waking so early to join us. And thank you for this epic processing work you've done, not just for Mumia Abu-Jamal and for historians and for the world, but for that thing we call hope. And I'm thinking of a poem whose author escapes me right now. Maybe Mariposa can remind me. But let's I mentioned the poet to her not long ago, and she's from the Northeast, Emily Dickinson. Emily Dickinson has a poem about hope. And she says that hope is the thing that you can't see that has wings, and that allows you to wake up another day. Tell us about the work you do. What does it mean to create a catalog of a person's papers?
So the technical version of it is, no matter whose papers I get, we take the raw form of these materials. So think about what the boxes of things you've acquired over the years that are in your attic or in your basement, however those are. They come to me and I open up these boxes and I see what's there. And it is my job to make order and meaning out of these materials. Always, of course, working from a feminist ethic of care, where I'm working with our donor to make sure that I'm not making any uninformed decisions while I'm doing that work. But I'm often trying to find like items, make groupings of materials so that the sense for researchers can begin to form. And then I go through sometimes, in the case of Mumia's papers, item by item, but at least grouping by grouping, to start to bring a little bit more clarity to what is here, what are the topics they discuss, what kinds of records are they? Are they diaries? Are they correspondence? Are they artwork? And I handwrite all of the folders for every box for these materials. And then there's some cataloging work involved, some coding work involved, so that I can create what we call a finding aid, which is a guide to these collections. It tells you all about the person who donated the materials, the kinds of materials that you'll find in these collections, so that researchers can determine if this would be helpful to whatever they're pursuing. And that's what I do day in and day out for any collection, and in particular for Mumia's collection.
And for those of us who collect things and squirrel things away in boxes and in shelves and in closets, we know that the process is very emotional and people can't really detach themselves from their things. And it's very difficult to see what's in there with an objective eye. So I imagine that you're identifying themes and patterns for the list of for the catalog for historians and researchers and just the general public to be able to do a word search, perhaps. I'm just reminded of my own things and just how difficult it is and it was to organize it. And I had high hopes for organizing it, but when you're so close to your things, it's very difficult to just with a cool head, go to the things that are important and even organize them in order of importance. So we thank you for the work you do, because archivists and their work are not known in our society. Tell us about your first reaction to the assignment before you.
This project has been so formative on so many levels. There are days throughout what started, I guess, about 3 years ago now, that I just remember, and I can take myself there vividly. And the day my supervisor, Mary Murphy, who did the good and hard work to get this collection to Brown, I remember her standing in front of me in the office saying, "You'll never believe what I just learned. We might have a chance of getting the papers of Mumia Abu-Jamal." And she was so excited. And I was like, I have no idea who this person is, but okay. You know, in my head, it was just going to be any other collection. And I think we both, a lot of us who worked on this project in different capacities, were very doe-eyed about what that process would look like. So I just said, okay, that's cool. And I did a quick Wikipedia search, and I thought, wow, that's unlike any collection that I've worked on, but this is going to be interesting. And it certainly was, but not for any of the ways that I had anticipated.
So what was your knee-jerk image of Mumia once you conducted that Wikipedia search?
So I didn't really have one, quite honestly. I want to start all of this conversation by saying that it's a complete and total myth that archivists are objective, unbiased people. And that's something that I think is very important in the profession and in the world of people looking at library and archives to know. But I attempt to approach these things with a very technical and practical mindset about what needs to get done and how to do it. So I was still really going into this project in that way, where I just didn't really have a feeling one way or another. But now, if you're looking for an actual image, when I close my mind and my mind's eye, I've never met Mumia in person, but the image I have is from a photo that you took with him in the early 2000s. I believe Heidi Boghossian was there as well. And it's this one image in particular that I see Mumia with this big smile on his face, dreadlocks, and the two of you just look so happy. And that's sort of the image that I have of Mumia in my mind.
Wow, that's really wonderful to hear. And Heidi Boghossian is going to be delighted, because when we were visiting Mumia for the first time when he got off death row in 2011, I believe. I think I'm right about that.
Yes, 2011.
In 2011. This was the first time that we could actually touch him, mm-hmm. right? He hadn't been touched in 28 years. Mm-hmm. He hadn't had lunch with anybody for that long, and we were just giddy. And when we went up to take photographs, we were just like children making faces and just doing silly things in front of the camera to lighten up the moment, but also because we were just beside ourselves that we could finally break bread mm-hmm. With Mumia and hug him and kiss him upon seeing him, which was not the case when we visited him on death row. So it's great that those photographs just left an imprint in your soul, because that's what's the intention. You've been listening to the voice of Amanda Knox, the assistant archivist at Brown University's Pembroke Center, and the person assigned the job of cataloging the archive of imprisoned radio journalist and veteran Black Panther, Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your Friday host of What's Going On, and you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York and WBAI.org on the web. And we're going to take calls in a minute. The number to call is 212-209-2877 in more than a minute, in like 10 minutes. So please wait before you call us. The number to call is 212-209-2877. Tell us about what's actually in the collection. What did you find in there?
This collection is outstanding for so many reasons. if for nothing else, just as an archival collection, it has everything an archivist would hope for. So many handwritten pieces of correspondence to Mumia. We had about 20 boxes of correspondence to Mumia from various people around the world, including Italy, France, Germany, particularly around the time he got off death row, but across his imprisonment altogether. There's artwork by Mumia. There are boxes upon boxes of Mumia's own writings in his handwriting. There are, of course, some prison records, grievance forms, commissary receipts, things of that nature that really document his life in prison. There are boxes and boxes of books that either he requested or were sent to him, newspapers, family photographs are in there, photographs that somebody sent him after Katrina hit. It's just a really wonderful historical record of the United States, of imprisonment, and of Mumia's life.
Wow. I'm sure we could go on and on and on. Correspondence mm-hmm. between Mumia and his many supporters mm-hmm. active in the process of freeing him. I imagine that the process of discovery didn't happen all at once. And I'm talking about the broader discoveries that you might have made. It must have been like peeling an onion. Talk to us about what you discovered over time.
Yeah, so it's sort of interesting. When I begin processing, after I do this sorting that I was kind of talking about, I have things in their major groupings. I decide where I really want to dig in first. And it's not always a clear-cut start at the beginning of the collection, go to the end. It's sort of where I think I'm going to learn the most first that will help me make decisions about these other items that I come up with. And so I did begin with what we call the personal and biographical series, where we have a lot of the photographs, drafts of Mumia's dissertation, some of his transcripts, photographs, and the prison records. And gosh, up to that point, there had been so much work going into getting the collection there. I already knew that this was unlike anything that we were going to be dealing with. But just to kind of paint a picture for you, I am a white, middle-class, cisgendered woman from New England. I have always been those things. I have never had reason to fear a police officer. I have often thought about these systems. 50% of my immediate family are or were police officers. And it's something that I've often thought about, and that definitely played into a lot of my awareness around the decisions I was making in processing these collections. And I just learned so much about Mumia right from the get-go. To see things like prison records, like commissary receipts, grievance forms, attempts to get any kind of medical care at all, juxtaposed with his family photographs and his PhD dissertation, it was kind of like just an immediate look at what this person is doing under these circumstances, look at the circumstances they're living in. And that just continued to unfold throughout the collection. I often say that if we were to remove a few boxes from the collection, you probably wouldn't even be able to guess that Mumia is an incarcerated person. It's really outstanding. So it was a long process. As you had mentioned, it took about a year of work to process this collection. And I just learned so much about him over time, from how intelligent he is, the way he thinks about the world, to looking at his commissary receipts and learning that he really likes to order a lot of dark chocolate and mixed nuts and Triscuits. And these are just kind of weird things that you learn about people when you're doing this work.
I mean, you are the daughter of a police officer, and Mumia Abu-Jamal is wrongly accused of killing a police officer in Philadelphia. on December 9th, 1981. Can you, I mean, fate must have intervened in this turn of events with his papers. Can you tell us a little bit about that, about the tension that this might have created in you when you learned about his case, about what you brought in to the project, even though you want to, and you've said that you do this in a very detached, detailed, organized way as your job. But as you said, archivists are not objective. And to talk to us about your family and how your family has received this this project of yours.
Yeah, there was such a learning process all the way around about who Mumia is and who I am and how we are situated in society. And you best believe I asked myself more than once, how the heck did I end up in this position? Of all the people in the whole world, like, how did I become the person processing Mumia Abu-Jamal's papers? And I do want to be clear from the get-go that I am a proud daughter of a police officer, a proud sister of a police officer, but I am not in any way disillusioned by the fact that these systems are not created to support people of color. In many instances, they are created to hurt people of color. And of course, as a child, as a young person, that was not anything I ever thought of. And I think, this is a very privileged position. At the time, my world just didn't really ask those questions. And it wasn't until I went to college where we really started to look at those things. And it puts me in a very odd position. Just even going back to watching Black Lives Matter protests on the news, and just feeling this conflict inside of me about where I should be situated in this conversation. And oftentimes, particularly as a white woman, I don't really think it is my job to be taking up too much space in those conversations other than to be supporting the people who are contributing to them. But it's definitely just odd. And difficult. And one thing I really appreciated from the mass incarceration symposium, a student asked a really great question, and Angela Davis pointed out that we are always living in contradiction. And that is just kind of how we exist in the world. And this was definitely that moment for me. All of that being said, my family and I do not always see eye to eye on these topics, but my parents were definitely very supportive as I moved through this project, and told them about all of the difficulties we were encountering. They were always very supportive of me being on the project, of Brown acquiring the papers, which was really wonderful to have.
What were some of your other challenges?
There were so many. The challenges were definitely, I think, more of the onion that you were referencing. With each stage of acquiring this collection and processing this collection, there were just new and different challenges that we didn't expect. And I think for me, one of my biggest challenges was just trying so hard to be aware of how different my position in society is in comparison to Mumia's. And I was just so petrified that I was going to make an egregious mistake. And I just kept saying, like, you don't know what you don't know. And it was just terrifying. And so in an attempt to avoid that, I would do my processing work from 9 to 5. And then I would go home and I would watch every documentary I could find and listen to the interviews. And it was the first time for any collection that I had really immersed myself in that way. And that ended up not being a great situation for myself, because it became this, my life became about Mumia's life at every single moment. And Mumia's life is a very difficult life. It's a very difficult life to be confronted with. As you pointed out, and as the listeners know, you know, this is a life in the margins of society. It's a life that we often don't have to think about or encounter. And so to be doing that 24/7 was really, really challenging. It got to the point where I was seeing Mumia in my dreams every single night. And that was terrifying at first. And then it was sort of like, hi, Mumia, I will be at work soon. And I was just really afraid of letting down our researchers and the university and the people who want access to this collection and Mumia. I was afraid of misrepresenting him and his collection. And that was what was particularly difficult for me, was just constantly being aware of the differences in our lives, and trying to do what I could to learn to make sure that I wasn't making those mistakes.
You're listening to the voice of Amanda Knox, the assistant archivist at Brown University's Pembroke Center and the person assigned the job of cataloging the archive of imprisoned radio journalist and veteran Black Panther, Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your Friday host of What's Going On, and you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York and WBAI.org on the web. The number to call for questions is 212-209-2877. Once again, that number to call is 212-209-2877. So how did your perception of Mumia change through the archive?
He became, this is going to sound odd, because he is, of course, a very human individual. But I think because of his story and because of how much has been generated about him in the media on all sides, there's really this image of him that is almost sort of mythical in nature. And so going into it, that was kind of all I had to go off of, was this sort of mythical image of Mumia and what he represented and what he stood for. And so the more and more I worked on the collection, like I said, I learned like the food that he liked to eat. I learned about his health struggles. I just learned about him as a human in the world. And that was really fun and interesting to feel that unfold and to see that unfold in this collection. And I'm really excited that this collection will hopefully be giving researchers the opportunity to see him in that way, because he also makes it very clear in a lot of his writings and a lot of his work that he doesn't want to be held as some sort of a god, almost. Like he wants people to realize that he is an individual going through this. And I'm hoping that the work that's been done on the collection and just the choices that he made in curating this collection will show everybody that side of him.
So now tell us, who is Mumia to you?
Oh, goodness. This is a question I don't want to answer, because I don't. So many of these questions, I have different answers depending on when I've been asked them over the course of my processing. I think Mumia is a dad. He's a husband who is now, unfortunately, a widow. I think he is a brilliant thinker. And he's an activist, and he's just, this sounds very basic, but he's just a regular dude who's having to live his life in these just outrageous circumstances. And that those are kinds of the highlights that I think of when I think of who is Mumia.
By the way, that's what I also think, that Mumia is a dude. He's a particularly brilliant dude.
Yes.
But he's a dude in prison who's been framed by the state. We've got callers. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, good morning. My name is Angel. How are you guys doing today?
Good morning. We're well, Angel. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I had a question about the process. I used to be the president of a friends group of the Central Library. And one of the issues about archival is having the resources. So I'm just I'd like to ask on a couple of points. One, do you have the resources to once this is done that you, it'll be digitized and available to the public? And secondly, how far and wide will the collection be? So, for example, if there are FBI files on him, would that be included? What about his radio broadcasts? And lastly, I'm part of a group called Radical Elders, and a year and a half ago, he did a tape for us welcoming us and becoming a Radical Elder. So if that's something that you can use, we would gladly like to donate that as well. It's just in a digitized form, obviously. So just wanted to have that kind of question put to you. Thank you.
Wow. What a great question. Can you take notes, Amanda, so that we can take other calls just right up front?
I certainly can try.
Well, why don't you answer this question? Because this is a fascinating, very technical question.
Yes. So right off the top, what I can share is that a good chunk of parts of this collection have already begun to be digitized. They were digitized for an exhibit that is currently up at the John Hay Library in Providence, Rhode Island on Brown University's campus. If you go to the finding aid at riamco.org, RIAMCO.org, and type in Mumia's name, the finding aid will come up, and those items that have been digitized are linked in that inventory. So you will be able to see them online. There are plans to digitize more of the collection in the future. I have not really been part of those conversations, so I can't say what the timeline for that is. In terms of resources, there were all sorts of resources that were demanded for this collection, including and certainly not limited to the salaries of all of the people who were involved in making this happen over the last 3 years, getting the collection to campus, processing the collection. And then certainly 97 boxes and all of the folders that you can fit in 97 boxes. There are definitely a lot of resources that go into making this work happen. And we are very lucky to be at a place like Brown that has the resources to be able to devote to these collections to ensure their long-term care. In terms of additional items, so anything in the collection, everything in the collection is what was curated by Mumia himself. And so that is what would go into his papers or any items that Mumia continues to generate. We did not take any items that were attorney-client privileged or had any sort of legal kind of restriction around them. Fun fact, libraries cannot hold up two warrants. So if even though we can put a restriction on items for researchers, if police show up with a warrant to get access to those items, they can certainly get access to those items. So we did not want to keep anything of that nature. But I don't know, Johanna, if there's sort of a more private way we can route my email to some listeners if they're interested in reaching out to me with additional items that they have, or actually generally more easily for these items like what sounds to be your audio or videotapes, just send an email to Pembroke_archives@brown.edu, and we can try to handle that question more one-on-one.
Or you can email us at marcos@wbai.org. Marcos, M-A-R-C-O-S at wbai.org. But that digitized tape of Mumia joining Radical Elders just sounds really important.
Mm-hmm.
We've got callers. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Good morning. My name is Mariposa.
Mariposa, Amanda. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much for the topic this morning. My question relates to ethics. And you touched on this when you first began speaking. And you spoke about an ethics of care. Can you explain why this is important and also your thoughts on how to level the the disparity in terms of people from marginalized communities and experiences being able to have access to become archivists like yourself, to have the experience. How do we as educators, I'm a lecturer in the Department of English at Lehman College in CUNY, how do we as scholars and as professors give our students opportunities to handle physical archives and digital archives, and also expand it so that we can do it in creative ways, in ways that as an artist, as a poet, I can't wait to go up to Brown and meet you and go through the archives and think of ways to bring the archives alive in poetry and on stage, so that everyday working people can have access to them, people that won't have the time to visit your archive. Mm. So I know it's a long question, but it relates to, one, data ethics. What is that? Why is it important? And how do we create pathways so that people from marginalized experiences have opportunities to have a career like the fabulous career you have? Thank you.
Wow. Thank you so much for that question. We're going to take another caller. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, this is Mike from Brooklyn. Can you hear me?
We can.
Thank you, Dr. Fernandez, and your guest. I really appreciate the work that you all are doing. I'm in Brooklyn, so I want to give a shout out to Interference Archive.
Whoa, yes, thank you.
Radical Archive. I was wondering if there's something like that up in Providence. It seems to me that Mumia's papers should be in Philly, but I know that that's, negotiated at a higher level at universities, and I understand the need for sustained academic engagement with the materials, but also I think as the other callers have touched on, you know, it's important for the community to actually get their hands on the physical objects. It's one thing to digitize it, but for people to see and feel and smell the material is something else. And I know there's a tension there between preservation and access. So I was wondering if your guest could speak to some of that stuff and what the scene is up in Providence. Maybe there can be some like joint like Brown and some other community space efforts.
Mike,
thank you so much.
Can you tell us what Interference Archive is quickly?
Oh, it's in like Gowanus Park Slope. It's a radical space. I think coming out of the Occupy Wall Street movement, the people there are graphic designers associated with Just Seeds, and it's a space in a storefront, which is a miracle in Park Slope considering the rents, where people, curate shows based on a whole archive of material of ephemera from social movements from like the last, 70 years. I don't know how far back the collection stretches, but they have a lot of really great stuff and people can go. It's mostly open on the weekends. They do, classes come, there's events. It's a really great space. They're online and on all the socials.
Thank you so very much, Mike. Okay, we're going to turn it back to you, Amanda.
Yes, I did get to take notes. So, I will go back to our first question in terms of the ethics of care. So this is something that I bring up because the Pembroke Center's full name is the Pembroke Center for Teaching and Research on Women. We really focus on feminist thought and activism, and that is primarily what the collections are that I work on. And so we really work from sort of a different perspective from what a lot of archives work from, and that is really treating our donors with care and consideration and involving them in every step of the process, which was important to me to try to do the same as much as possible with Mumia. He was able to have some phone conversations with, again, my supervisor, Mary Murphy, of course, through Johanna as well. We got some correspondence from him. So we were trying to involve him as much as we possibly would with anybody else. Of course, that was a little bit more difficult and still a little bit more limited, but it was very important that we try to do that because, of course, as I'm as we're talking about this, like it is very clear that I'm taking other people's things and then kind of as I've been saying, trying to make meaning out of them. But it's these other people's things, and they know where the meaning is and where they want the emphasis to be placed. And it's not my job to really make those decisions if I have the privilege of having the donors or the contributors available to help guide me in applying the practical work to what is often a very emotional and personal process as well.
We now, have about a minute left.
Okay, so then I just want to say, in terms of providing access, preservation versus access, at the Pembroke Center, we provide as much access as we possibly can. We often have classes come in so that they can touch and feel these materials. They are still preserved. They are still safe. People can touch them. People can access them. The John Hay Library is a Carnegie Library, so that means even though it's at Brown, it is open to the public. And I just encourage anybody who's looking to get students or themselves into an archive, reach out to an archivist at your university, at a local institution, and ask them about instructional sessions. Ask about bringing your students into the archive so that they can have that experience.
Glasses, Mumia's glasses were in the boxes, and there was a radio that was purchased by him in the prison that was see-through, transparent. And I imagine that that's for purposes of security. But the things in there are just absolutely fascinating. I also want to make an announcement that Judith, one of our listeners, says that she recommends the Bread and Puppet production that's going on at the Theater of the New City. It is a brilliant rendering of what's happening in Palestine. Do you have any final, just last thoughts before we leave?
I just want to thank everybody so much for being interested in this work. Please, I encourage you to learn more about the libraries and archives in your area, including these activists and community-run libraries and archives. Speak with the archivists. These institutions are not, should not be as gatekept as people imagine they are. Don't be afraid to email an archivist, ask for access, ask to learn more. Most of us would be very happy to do that.
One thing you told me during our conversation was that working on this collection opened you up to love and made you more vulnerable. You want to say anything about that?
I really thought that seeing Mumia's life, how he lives his life, everything he's been through would at the very least make Mumia angry, if not make me angry. And there were definitely parts of it that made me very angry. But it also just made me want to care about people more. It just made me feel like we just need to care about each other more. And maybe some of the decisions we make around the systems that we create, how we treat other people, would change if we just all felt a little bit more cared for in the world.
You've been listening to the voice of Amanda Knox, assistant archivist at the Pembroke Center at Brown University. Amanda was the person assigned the job of cataloging the archive of imprisoned radio journalist and veteran Black Panther, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Thank you so very much, Amanda, for joining us and for your epic work.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been an amazing opportunity.
And we need to uphold the work of Mary Murphy, without whose efforts this would not be a reality today. You've been listening to non-commercial, listener-funded community radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York and WBAI.org on the web. It's 7:58 and 39 degrees in Central Park this morning, Friday, December 15th, 2023. We're rebuilding the world together and ushering in a new day. This show is produced by Johanna Fernandez and Marcos Maldonado Cruz. Our executive producer is Linda Perry. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. We'll leave you with Algo Bonito by Ile Ivy Queen. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. See you next Friday. Como leona de cacería, ya me tienen las huevas hinchadas. Si protesto, me llaman subversiva. Y sé que mi rabia te incomoda, porque sé que me prefieres compasiva. Suena ese llamado que despierta, que nos libera el peso de encima. A ese monstruo le tiembla la pierna, sabe que su derrumbe se
is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it